Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Marjorie Cohn, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, who examines the role of the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court in holding both Israeli and Hamas leaders accountable for war crimes committed by both sides in the war in Gaza. Dr. Crystal Cavalier Keck and her husband Jason Crazy Bear Keck, who discussed the People's Tribunal they convened to expose the natural gas Mountain Valley Pipeline's violation of the rights of nature. And Laura Carlson, with Mexico City-based Just Associates, who assesses the significance of Claudia Sheinbaum's historic election victory as Mexico's first female president. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For the first time in 30 years, South Africa's ruling African National Congress lost its majority in an election, winning only 40% of the popular vote. President Cyril Ramaphosa is now leading negotiations to form a unity government. While the pro-business center-right Democratic Alliance Party came in second, the real surprise was the success of former disgraced President Jacob Zuma and his MK party. Zuma, who was forced to resign over corruption scandals, won a plurality of the vote in his native KwaZulu-Natal province, where the ANC came in third. The MK party has refused to negotiate with the ANC until Zuma's main rival, Ramaphosa, resigns the presidency. The ANC is looking for coalition partners among the mostly white Democratic Alliance Party, breakaway ANC factions including Zuma's MK party and the leftist Economic Freedom Fights led by expelled ANC youth wing leader Julius Malema. South Africa's 2024 election witnessed the lowest voter turnout in 30 years, with voter disillusionment running high due to rampant crime, power outages, and mass unemployment. Ramaphosa's job as president is at risk because the ANC must organize a coalition government before a new president can be elected. This spring, H5N1 infections, commonly known as bird flu, are on the rise in dairy cattle ranches across the U.S., which has now resulted in the infection of three immigrant dairy workers in Michigan and Texas. Since March 29th, there has been a major outbreak of bird flu in dairy cows, with 86 infected herds across 11 states. According to The Hill, only three human cases have been confirmed because state and federal authorities have not actively nor systematically looked for new cases of infection in humans. Without a goal-oriented governmental response to the H5N1 outbreak and a public health surveillance strategy that is aligned with these larger goals, the U.S. will not understand the true extent and implications of the outbreak, failing to protect its citizens and the rest of the world from a very real pandemic threat. There are 150,000 dairy workers, many who are undocumented immigrants. Poor working conditions among these workers has contributed to the spread of the virus. University of Minnesota epidemiologist Michael Osterholm says American agricultural interests have not wanted to know what's going on, and they've made it difficult for public health workers to visit farms and investigate this dangerous bird flu outbreak. The far-right paramilitary group Proud Boys played a key role in the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Since Donald Trump incited the failed coup attempt, four former Proud Boys leaders have been convicted in federal court of seditious conspiracy, each sentenced to 15 or more years in prison. At least another 70 members have been charged with participating in the violence. Yet, in recent months, a newly decentralized Proud Boys movement has emerged alongside the Trump campaign to retake the White House. In April, Proud Boys supporters rallied near Trump's golf course in Bedminster, New Jersey. There, a truck flew Trump and Proud Boys flags, with men inside wearing Proud Boys black and yellow shirts. Reuters reports that investigators estimate that there are now 154 active Proud Boys chapters in 48 states and 18 international chapters in 9 countries. Dozens of Proud Boys members marched in Columbus, Ohio, on the third anniversary of the January 6th insurrection. The growing presence of Proud Boys at Trump rallies has raised fear of the potential for escalating violence during this year's election campaign. At the same time, Trump's use of often incendiary language is inspiring his supporters to target his perceived enemies that include judges, prosecutors, witnesses, and political rivals in a wave of threats unprecedented in modern American politics. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Tens of thousands of protesters surrounded the White House in Washington, D.C. on June 8th, demonstrating their opposition to President Biden's handling of Israel's war in Gaza, which has, over the past 8 months, killed more than 37,000 Palestinians. Hundreds of participants formed a 2-mile-long human chain carrying a continuous strip of red fabric, symbolizing the red line that Biden had earlier declared regarding his opposition to a planned Israeli attack on the southern Gaza city of Rafah, crowded with over 1.5 million Palestinian refugees. Despite Biden's warning, Israel launched its offensive in Rafah on May 7th, seizing control of Gaza's border crossing with Egypt that cut off a vital route for humanitarian aid desperately needed by more than 1 million Palestinians on the brink of starvation. On May 27th, Israeli forces bombed a tent encampment in Rafah, killing 45 mostly women and children, and injuring more than 200 others. During an IDF military operation in the densely populated central Gaza Nusrat refugee camp that freed 4 Israeli hostages held by Hamas on June 8th, 274 Palestinians were killed, with some 698 others wounded. In an effort to prevent further harm to Palestinian civilians in Gaza, the United Nations top court, the International Court of Justice, or ICJ, had issued a ruling on May 24th calling on Israel to immediately halt its military offensive in Rafah, an order that Israel ignored. Your reporter spoke with Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and past president of the National Lawyers Guild, who examines the role of the International Court of Justice and International Criminal Court in holding both Israeli and Hamas leaders accountable for the war crimes committed by both sides in the war in Gaza.
Well, it was Israel's assault on Rafah that actually propelled the International Court of Justice to issue this preliminary order on May 24th. And the court called on Israel to immediately halt its military offensive and any other action in the Rafah governorate, which may inflict on the Palestinian group in Gaza conditions of life that could bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. And the court also ordered Israel to keep the Rafah crossing open and allow UN investigative commissions and other investigators to enter Gaza and investigate allegations of genocide.
So the International Criminal Court is seeking arrest warrants for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other Israeli officials, as well as Hamas officials responsible for the group's October 7th attack on Israel that killed 1,200 Israelis and kidnapped 240 hostages brought back to Gaza, which the IDF is trying to free with these bombing raids that have killed an overwhelming number of Palestinian civilians. Tell us about the significance of the International Criminal Court's warrant for the leaders of Israel as well as Hamas.
The arrest warrants that the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has asked the court to issue for Netanyahu and Gallant, the two top Israeli leaders. Of course, Netanyahu is the prime minister of Israel, and Yoav Gallant is the defense minister. The chief prosecutor of the ICC, International Criminal Court, Karim Khan, is asking for arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant for war crimes and crimes against humanity. He's asking for arrest warrants for the war crimes of starvation of civilians as a method of warfare, willful killing and murder, willfully causing great suffering or serious bodily injury, and intentionally directing attacks against a civilian population. Khan is asking for arrest warrants also against Netanyahu and Gallant for the crimes against humanity of extermination, murder, persecution, and other inhumane acts. And he's also asking for arrest warrants for three Hamas leaders, Yahya Sinwar, Mohammed Diab Ibrahim al-Masri, and Ismail Haniya, for the war crimes of taking hostages, cruel treatment, and outrages upon personal dignity. And Khan is asking for arrest warrants against the three Hamas leaders for the crimes against humanity of extermination, murder, rape, and other sexual violence, torture, and other inhumane acts. And by the way, he's been dragging his feet for a long time, ever since he came into office, and his predecessor, Fatou Bensouda, after a five-year preliminary examination, found a reasonable basis to believe that Israeli leaders and Hamas were engaged in war crimes and crimes against humanity. But the court basically dragged its feet for two more years, and it wasn't until the genocide, which is ubiquitous, it's transparent, and the Rafah attack, the Rafah tent massacre, I call it in this piece, but the ongoing genocide spurred Karim Khan to bring this request for these charges against these Israeli and Hamas leaders. Netanyahu responded to Khan's request for arrest warrants for him and Gallant as a moral outrage of historic proportions and a travesty of justice that sets a dangerous precedent and flies in the face of Israel's right to self-defense. Joe Biden blasted Khan's actions against the two Israeli leaders, calling it outrageous. Biden also said there is no equivalence, none, between Israel and Hamas.
With it being unlikely that Israeli leaders or Hamas leaders are going to be appearing in a court as a defendant in these war crimes cases, what's the importance of sanctions and an arms embargo on this current war and carnage in Gaza?
If there was an arms embargo and it was enforceable, the U.S. supplies most of the weapons for Israel's genocide, but other countries do as well. Germany is the second largest supplier of weapons to Israel. If the countries really did honor an arms embargo, if it was called for internationally and they honored it, that would put a crimp in Israel's continuing genocidal campaign, and sanctions against Israel would also punish Israel for what they're doing. Another thing that people can do, and it's really important, is to join the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS. Go to bds.org. And there are many products that benefit the Israeli economy that are being boycotted. There's divestment from corporations that have investments in Israel, and it has been so successful since it's a nonviolent program by Palestinian civil society. It was initiated in 2005, and it's been so effective that Netanyahu called it an existential threat to Israel. So that's something that people can actually do, in addition to writing to Congress members, to the White House, to the State Department, and exercising their First Amendment rights to protest.
That was Marjorie Cohn, Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, and past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Find a link to her recent article titled "Following International Court of Justice in International Criminal Court Actions, Sanctions and Arms Embargo Are Crucial Next Steps," and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In May 2023, West Virginia U.S. Senator Joe Manchin inserted a requirement into a bipartisan debt ceiling agreement mandating completion of the controversial 303-mile Mountain Valley Frack Gas Pipeline, or MVP, through Virginia and West Virginia. The deal made with Democratic Senate Party leaders overrode any judicial or environmental regulatory decisions against the pipeline. Indigenous activists in North Carolina took a creative approach to exposing damages caused by the pipeline that included an extension into the state of North Carolina called Southgate. They organized a People's Tribunal on June 1st to expose the Mountain Valley Pipeline's violation of the rights of nature and foster an understanding of how the MVP is destroying the health of rivers and waterways. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with the convener of the tribunal, Dr. Crystal Cavalier Keck of the Okanichi Band of the Saponi Nation, and her husband Jason Crazy Bear Keck of the Louisiana Choctaw Bands. Here they explain how they work with the United Nations to bring the tribunal to North Carolina with the support of Movement Rights, an organization that works to align human law with the laws of the natural world.
I put together a case presentation, and I actually wrote to the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature to ask if we could hold a tribunal for this, and we had to take it before the Assembly of Judges with the International Tribunal organization, and they agreed that we could hold a local tribunal. So in September, there will be an international tribunal held close to the United Nations, and this will be one of the cases presented. So it will get a global view of, we talk about the regulatory agencies not doing their jobs, as well as the governments not really upholding the citizens of the United States, not upholding their constitutional rights and having these corporations violate them. It's all in the name for greed, right? You know, lying in somebody's pocket at the end of the day.
I know that the Mountain Valley Pipeline was found guilty.
And they were invited to defend themselves and did not show.
We did. We invited the state of Virginia, the state of West Virginia, the state of North Carolina, the Mountain Valley Pipeline. They were all invited. And we actually had put West Virginia and Virginia as defenders because, you know, they allowed these pipelines to come through. And so they have let down the public in holding up their regulatory duties, you know, violating environmental justice acts, getting bought and paid off by the pipeline, you know, everything you can imagine.
This tribunal or the result of it is going to be brought up at the UN. Is that sort of the next step? And what does that mean for the pipeline? Does that mean anything in terms of trying to stop it in any way? It's obviously public opinion is important.
It is public opinion. You know, I wish they could stop it, but they won't be able to stop it. But I can just go over a couple of the judges' rulings, right? And, you know, this is more for administrative because there's no military to enforce this, right, in the United Nations. So, you know, MVP is a violation of the rights of nature and should be stopped. The president, which was Casey Camp Hornick, asked audience and witnesses if the pipeline was necessary or offered any value by show of hands. Unanimously, all present said no. You know, the MVP Southgate should not be approved. So it was more of, you know, this is a tribunal for the people in the community. And, you know, if our lawmakers had our votes at heart, they would listen to what the people have to say. And what that means is what we're going to have to do is take this precedent of this tribunal, and we're going to have to take it to the streets because this is an election year. And we really do not want to have these elected officials in office who are not holding polluters or land destroyers accountable, right? We need to remove those people from office. And that's what I say. So anybody who was complacent or stood by and allowed the pipeline to go through, they need to get out of office. Whether you were an appointed position or you're an elected position, we need to organize and get you out. And that's what it's going to take is people power to organize and get people out of the rally.
One of the things that was said at the tribunal was that 100% of pipe fail 100% of the time. 80% of pipes fail in first 10 years. And these stats are when a pipeline is built on flat terrain, not through the Appalachians, and not with pipes that weren't engineered for such a task.
And not having sat out in the open for 6 years.
For years, right, compromised, already failing testing. Like this last month, I believe they failed testing, and they're like, oh, so what? Still put it in. You know, it's all about making the money on getting the project open. It's not about whether it's viable, useful, dangerous, you know, all of these things.
That was Dr. Crystal Cavalier Keck, convener of the June 1st People's Tribunal on the harms caused by the Mountain Valley Pipeline, and her husband Jason Crazy Bear Keck. Learn more about opposition to the pipeline by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The people of Mexico made history in the nation's June 2nd national election when Morena Party presidential candidate Claudia Sheinbaum was elected Mexico's first female and first Jewish president by a landslide. Sheinbaum, a climate scientist and former Mexico City mayor, is a protege of popular outgoing president Andrés Manuel López Obrador. The president-elect defeated Xochitl Galvez, the candidate of the center-right Broad Front for Mexico coalition, who was a sitting senator with indigenous roots. The Mexican election was marred by extreme violence, with the assassination of 38 local candidates for office during the course of the campaign. For many years, drug cartels have employed violence to expand their control in states throughout the country. Sheinbaum vowed to continue López Obrador's popular social programs, but it's not known if she'll pursue a different path from her predecessor and mentor. Your reporter spoke with Laura Carlson, coordinator of Global Solidarity and Learning with Just Associates in Mexico, and director of the Mexico City-based think tank MIRA, Feminisms and Democracies. Here she discusses the significance of Claudia Sheinbaum's election victory and the domestic and foreign policy challenges she'll face when she's sworn into office on October 1st.
I think it is very significant that Mexico elected its first woman president. What that means is that they were able to break through a very macho culture and macho political culture, and the majority by far of the people accepted the idea of a woman running the country. Now, this isn't something that just happened, and it's not something that just happened because she was ushered in by the outgoing president. This is actually the result in large part of decades of work by Mexican feminist movements. They began with requiring quotas and equal representation in governmental posts. Little by little, they passed laws that would require parties to put up women candidates and to break the prejudice that existed in terms of leadership and representation. Every time there was an advance, say, in a law that would require a 30% quota for women candidates, there'd be some kind of loophole that people would find, and then they'd have to go back to the legislation and close up the loopholes. I mean, we had so many cases of women who ran for office, and then, you know, a week later they gave the office to their husbands, or of giving all the candidacies in the places they knew they were already going to lose to the women to fill the quotas. You know, it's been a really long and hard road, but it's seen significant advances. Before this election, we already had, with this incoming government of López Obrador, we already had a cabinet that was 50% women at one point. There have been some changes. And a Congress, almost 50% women as well. And that reflects a commitment on the part of his Morena party. So there's been advances that paved the way for Claudia Sheinbaum to become first the candidate of the Morena party and then to win the elections, and not only win the elections, but I think that's the second significant point here, but to win them, as you mentioned, by a landslide. We're talking about a 30-point margin between Claudia Sheinbaum and her closest rival, Xochitl Galvez of the Conservative Coalition. So in a continent that's been seeing the advance in a world, really, of the far right, here we have Mexico moving in the opposite direction. There's a lot of explanations for why this happened. One of them is clearly the popularity of the outgoing president. He's maintained about a 60% approval rating throughout his presidency, one of the highest in the world and certainly in the region. He has a policy of speaking directly to the people through the televised press conferences every morning. It seems to be a form of communication that really works. And then also, of course, the social programs, which are like pensions for the elderly, support for students and educational grants, supports to help people, young people especially, get into the labor market, supports for small agricultural producers. In one form or another, these social programs reach a huge number of Mexican families, and particularly among the most vulnerable sectors.
What are the major challenges President-elect Sheinbaum will face when she takes office on October 1st? Among the issues confronting Mexico is rampant violence, including the assassination of some 38 local candidates who were running for office during this most recent election campaign. Tell us about that, if you would.
Security and the violence in the country is clearly the biggest challenge that she'll face, because it's something that López Obrador was not able to resolve in his 6 years in office. And he came in with a very high homicide rate because of the war on drugs and the violence that had unleashed here in Mexico. And he's going out with a very high homicide rate. And that includes gender-based violence, femicides, which has been a huge complaint of Mexican feminist organizations, especially young feminists within the country, that there hasn't been improvement or greater emphasis placed on this. And, of course, the mothers of the disappeared have been constantly, and the family members, pointing out the almost indifference of the federal government to this problem of disappearances as well. So she has decided to continue with the same policy of the López Obrador government, which is to use the armed forces against the drug cartels. There are many of us, certainly myself included, that believe that this was, in fact, in 2006, one of the policy decisions that caused the violence rather than resolving it, and that there are extreme dangers in a democracy of relying on the armed forces for public safety tasks, which police should be doing.
That was Laura Carlson, coordinator of Global Solidarity and Learning with Just Associates and director of the Mexico City-based think tank MIRA, Feminisms and Democracies. Find more analysis and commentary on Claudia Sheinbaum's historic election victory by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WAAA in Epsom, New Hampshire, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KFUG in Crescent City, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.